Well, welcome to today's lecture. Can I just check, is this microphone working? You can hear me. Some people are nodding, some people are listening, that's good. Okay, welcome to this lecture. The lecture today is part of a European series of lectures at the LSE, which are hosted by the European Institute and are supported by the LSE's annual fund. Now, our speaker today, of course, will be well known to many of you, so I won't repeat his CV. Let me just remind you of the variety of careers he has had, however. A very quick list: a commando officer in the Royal Marines, a Foreign Office diplomat, businessman, youth worker, Member of Parliament, leader of the Liberal Democrat Party, member of the House of Lords, and most recently, High Representative of the International Community in Bosnia from 2002 to this last January. A glittering CV. I'm tempted to suggest, Paddy, that with that CV, you could possibly gain admission to the LSE on one of the European Institute's courses, and we would welcome any such application. It's his role in Bosnia, of course, which provides the background to today's talk. High Representative in Bosnia. If some saw this role as imperial, somewhat akin to a viceroy, then he clearly interpreted the role differently. Before going, he had argued passionately for international intervention after the awfulness of war and of ethnic cleansing. He's received widespread praise for his time in Bosnia. But of course, today, the situation in the region still poses many risks to stability and progress. We think of the negotiations currently underway over Kosovo, the demand for independence on the part of the Albanian population, and the resistance of the Serbs to any such change of status. We recall the intervention of NATO in 1999 and the pictures, the graphic representations on our TV screens of refugees. Kosovo remains something of a powder keg. This May, Montenegro will hold a referendum on the question of its independence from Serbia. The European Union says that it will not recognize the result of the referendum unless at least 55%. We're joined by forces beyond our control, but nevertheless, it's a very welcome audience. We look forward to the referendum this May in Montenegro on the question of independence. But the referendum itself poses controversies. The European Union says that it would not recognize the result unless at least 55% of those voting supported the proposition. For his part, the Montenegrin Prime Minister sees the European Union's approach as being fundamentally anti-democratic. Some Serb nationalists have even threatened civil war. So there are still a few nightmares out there in the region. But at the same time, economic change is occurring. Croatia has applied to join the European Union, following the lead of Slovenia. Other states like Serbia are looking forward to an EU application. And the economic landscape more generally is changing, with increased trade and investment, new transport corridors, cooperation in energy, and new agreements on the environment and on trafficking. So progress is being made, and the solutions increasingly involve Europe. So today's lecture fits very well the interests of the European Institute here at the LSE on Southeast Europe. And indeed, the school is developing quite an active interest in the Balkans. This last week, I believe, Enterprise LSE, the commercial arm of the school, has just been awarded a major contract from DFID to support economic policy making in Bosnia, for example. So today's talk is very topical. Let me remind you of the next two lectures coming up in this series. Tomorrow, in the Hong Kong Theatre, just after 1 o'clock, we have the EU Commissioner Charlie McCreevy talking about the future of the European capital markets. Later, on Tuesday the 21st of March, we have the Belgian Prime Minister, Guy Verhofstadt, talking about the United States of Europe, based on his recent book. And we look forward to making further announcements of additional lectures in the summer term. We're proud of the lecture series on Europe this year, and we're particularly proud of today's talk. Today's talk entitled, The Western Balkans, Are They Really Part of Europe? So please welcome our speaker, Lord Ashdown.
Well, thank you. It's a great privilege to be here and to join the extremely distinguished company of people who have spoken and lectured at the LSE in this forum. Thank you for that introduction as well. As you were reading through the jobs I'd done, I thought to myself, if you had a CV with all that many jobs on it, you wouldn't dream of giving anybody a job. But it's a strange old odyssey that ended up in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and I'm extremely lucky and very privileged to have been able to serve the international community and the people of Bosnia and Herzegovina in BIH in Bosnia over the last nearly 4 years. Well, C.L. Sulzberger, in his early 20th century book, which I can commend to you, A Long Row of Candles, describes the Balkans like this. The Balkans, which in Turkish simply means mountains, runs roughly from the Danube to the Dardanelles, from Istria to Istanbul, and is a term for the little lands of Hungary, Romania, Yugoslavia, Albania, Bulgaria, Greece, and part of Turkey. It is, he writes, or was, a gay peninsula filled with sprightly people who ate peppered food, drank strong liquors, wore flamboyant clothes, loved and murdered easily, and had a splendid talent for starting wars. Less imaginative Westerners looked down on them with secret envy, sniffing at their royalty, scoffing at their pretensions, fearing their savage terrorists. Karl Marx called them ethnic trash, but I adored them, as, by the way, so did I. Our late 20th century image of the Balkans is rather less romantic. For us, the Balkan Wars of the 1990s are remembered through those painful television images you referred to, of endemic war, of mindless horror, and irreversible dissolution into chaos. My point today is actually very simple and straightforward. Neither of these two visions, neither the romantic nor that terrible vision of the mid-1990s, is true. Neither reflects the true nature of the Balkans today, and neither should color our view of the potential of this region or of its importance to Europe in the early decades of this century. Or, put another way if you wish, the Western Balkans, which I shall incidentally redefine for the purpose of today's speech as the countries of ex-Yugoslavia, less those who are in or at the gates of Europe, less Croatia and Slovenia, plus Albania. The Western Balkans are not a faraway country of which we need know little, but a collection of nations which are naturally, culturally, geographically part of Europe within its present borders, and which it is in our interest as well as theirs to bring it within the European Union as quickly as possible. I shall also argue that if we in the EU are to do this, then we will need to have a much more effective and ambitious regional approach to the area, rather than a collection of penny packet policies for penny packet countries. I need no insult. And that we shall have to be more proactive in bringing them in, rather than sitting by waiting for it to happen. And that the centerpiece of this policy should be a more muscular approach to the application of European Union conditionality than we currently seem to believe to be necessary. That's what I shall be wanting to argue for you. First, let me dispel, if I may, that more modern 1990s image of the Western Balkans as an area irretrievably mired in war and chaos, what you might call the Rebecca West view, that this is the way the Balkans have always been, and this is the way they ever must remain. This has been a particularly prevalent view, surprisingly prevalent view in the past, and remains so today, even at the highest levels. I will recall, I think the year was 1993, when the Bosnian War was at its height, going to see the then British Foreign Secretary, pleading for the intervention, which was not to come for nearly two more years and countless tens of thousands more deaths. His response could have come straight from Rebecca West's Black Lamb and Grey Falcon. "But they've always been like this," he said, Paddy, I paraphrase. "They've always been like this. The best thing is to build a firebreak around the region and let it burn itself out." I pointed out to him that if there was any region of Europe who had always been like this, it was not the Balkans, but we in Northern Europe, who have fought each other much more frequently, with countless myriads more deaths and horrors than the Balkans over the last 1,000 years, if we could find the solution to our age-old conflicts within the European Union, how could we deny that solution to the Balkans as well? But you will recall, before our Europe, our Northern Europe, began its process of integration after the Second World War, there first had to be a period of European stabilization and reconstruction, assisted by the United States. Well, the countries of the West Balkans, assisted by the international community, including the US and the EU as key players, are just finishing that first phase of stabilization and reconstruction. And let me tell you, given where they were a mere 10 years ago, I think the progress in the Balkans has been remarkable, miraculous. I often used to say in Bosnia and Herzegovina that that previously shattered country has made far more progress from a terrible war to peace in 10 years than our own Northern Ireland has in nearly 35. Here in Bosnia and Herzegovina, the country I know best, is an example of what's happened just in the last 4 years. In those 4 years alone, these things have happened in Bosnia and Herzegovina. The armed forces, divided into two warring camps, have been unified and brought under the exclusive command of the control of the state. A program of reform that will in the coming years provide BIH with a democratically supervised and rationally organized police force at the state level has been started. Two customs services have been unified. Three intelligence services have been welded into one and brought under democratic parliamentary control. The judiciary has been cleaned up, depoliticized, and placed within a single countrywide framework. A single criminal code written by the Bosnians themselves has been established. The ruling Council of Ministers has been transformed into a genuine state-level government recognizable by any other European state, even if it isn't perfect. After years of frustratingly slow progress, the divided, warring city of Mostar has at last been unified. A single countrywide system of taxation, VAT, has been established. And GDP growth has been maintained in recent years at 5% or above, by the way, the fastest growth rate in the Western Balkans, while inflation stands at 0.5%, one of the lowest in Southeast Europe. Foreign direct investment in Bosnia and Herzegovina is now 5 times higher than it was in the late 1990s. Exports and industrial production are up 25%. Interest rates have halved since the year 2000. And by the way, a human figure, but still a remarkable one. All of this has been achieved within the context of an overarching effort to restore BIH's pre-war demographic pattern. Now, that effort has not succeeded entirely, but it has succeeded to a degree that no one would have dared believed possible a decade ago. I remember as a young soldier marching into Belfast in 1969 and seeing my own people, the Catholics, burnt out of their homes. Not a single one has returned. But in Bosnia and Herzegovina, more than a million of those who were displaced from their homes during that terrible war have since returned, hundreds of thousands of them now living in areas where they are in a minority. And by the way, this is the first time in history that I know that refugees, usually the left-out flotsam and jetsam of war, who have no choice but to settle where the conflict washed them up, have instead, in Bosnia, been able to return in such great numbers to the homes and the communities, even Srebrenica, from which they were driven in blood and horror only a decade ago. No one is claiming that the pre-war demographic pattern of Bosnia has been re-established, but the fact is that in all corners of Bosnia today, it remains essentially a multi-ethnic pattern of demography. And that is astonishing after a war which more or less invented in the modern terms the word ethnic cleansing. I don't want to concentrate too much in Bosnia. It happens to be the country I know best. So let me say that similar, if sometimes uneven, progress has been made and is being made in Croatia, remarkably in Croatia, but also Serbia and Montenegro, Albania, Macedonia, and hopefully soon in Kosovo too. Now, how has this happened? Or, perhaps more importantly, why? Why has it happened? Well, let me tell you why. Because in every single one of these countries, one single ambition unites all across every political, ethnic, cultural divide, a desire, a burning, urgent desire to be members one day soon of the European Union, which they, rightly in my view, see as their natural homework and the homeland and the framework within which they too will be able to resolve their ancient enmities. And incidentally, if I may, a word of warning. The Balkans region really is making progress, but I have to underline that in my view that progress is not irreversible yet. The prospect of joining the European Union is the one glue that holds the region on the path of reform and stabilization. If you take that glue away, if you remove the prospect of the European path, then I fear there is still a prospect, maybe even a real prospect, that all the progress of the last decade will go into reverse. And it is by no means impossible that we could then see again the re-emergence of the old visions and the old ideas which caused so much bloodshed in the region in the last century. So the people of the Western Balkans are clear why it is in their interests to join us. Why is it in our interest, our European Union interest, to have them do so? Well, first of all, Europe, and I refer now to the European Union within its present borders, cannot be complete with a back hole in its middle, or to be geographically precise, within its southeastern corner. Remember, you're talking about an area which is surrounded now on all sides by European Union members, or will be very shortly. This is not, and here is the central part of my argument, this is not a matter of extending the frontiers of the European Union. It is a matter of healing an abscess within the body of Europe itself. Nor is this just a question of geographical neatness. Europe saw in the last century, and I refer to the 20th century, Europe saw in the last 20th century how bloodletting in the Balkans can lead to even greater torrents of blood much closer to home. And even if the bloodletting can be confined to the Balkans, as in the 1990s, the tide of refugee, the infection of instability, cannot, as the expatriate Bosnian and Kosovar communities in almost every European Union country today bear witness. But there are reasons closer to home and closer to today why an abscess of instability and lawlessness within the European Union's borders spreads the infection of criminality into our own too. It is calculated that 80% of the trafficked women, a large proportion of the illegal immigrants, and a substantial element of our organized crime comes through the Balkan corridor. Please note, not necessarily from the Balkans, the majority not, but through the Balkans corridor. The effects of instability and lawlessness in the Balkans is therefore not some theoretical thing of interest only to historians, politicians, and statesmen. It is rather something which Europe's ordinary citizens feel daily, and sometimes painfully, all too frequently on the streets of Europe's cities. So there are powerful reasons why this piece of unfinished business in the European Union's integration process should now be completed by bringing these countries of the Western Balkans, whose combined populations are incidentally little bigger than that of Romania, due to join the European Union in the next year or so, and whose economies are only slightly larger, taken together, than that of Luxembourg, into the full embrace of the European Union as fast as practically possible. Now, the European Union recognized this reality, the reality that it was in our interest as well as theirs for this piece of unfinished business to be completed. It recognized that when in June 2003, under the highly successful in Balkan terms Greek presidency, the European Union made the Thessaloniki promise that it was ready to receive the Western Balkans nations into the Union when and as the Western Balkan nations brought themselves up to European standards. What Thessaloniki implicitly recognized, even if in language weaker than some of us might have wished for, was that for us in the European Union, this was not a matter of charity. It was a matter of self-interest as well as moral obligation. And one of those reasons of self-interest lies in the fact that the Western Balkans, I believe, can add value to Europe as an area of great cultural, ethnic, and natural resource. One aspect of this is, in our modern world, arguably of special importance. For planted within the Western Balkans, and especially in Bosnia and Herzegovina, is the 400-year-old phenomenon of European Islam. This is not the Islam we know in our inner cities, a generation or two old. This is Islam which is distinctly and proudly European, which sees, in the famous words of Bosnia's wartime president Ali Izetbegovic, neither conflict nor anomaly in being both a Muslim and a European, a tradition that stretches back over four centuries, an Islam which could not be radicalized, even in the face of being abandoned by the West for four genocidal years and suffering the horrors of Srebrenica and other areas. In Bosnia and Herzegovina, in Montenegro, in the Sanjak, in Albania, and in Macedonia, European Muslims are showing in their everyday lives that Islam can be no less a European religion than Judaism and Christianity. And in so doing, they are providing Europe with a much-needed insight into the gentle, tolerant, civilized, and civilizing values which are the true reality of Islam. In the dialogue of the deaf between too much of ancient Christendom and too much of present-day Islam, the insights of ancient European Islam in the Balkans has much to offer both sides. So here is my case. It is in Europe's interest to treat the Western Balkan countries not as a part of future enlargement beyond our current borders, but as unfinished business within the present borders of the European Union. And that it should be the Union's policy to treat the Thessaloniki promise, not passively, as an offer lying on the table for the Western Balkan nations to pick up if they can and wish to do so, but as a statement of active intent to take those bold steps necessary to bring the Western Balkan nations up to the standards required for EU membership and to bring them in as fast as it is practical to do so. There has, to be fair, recently been some movement in this direction. A policy paper is, I understand, due to be discussed with the European foreign ministers in a couple of days or so at Salzburg, which makes a similar case, maybe not in quite those straightforward terms. Well, I frankly hope this is going to be more than just a polite discussion. I hope rather that it marks a change of direction to something much more proactive, much more muscular in the EU's policy to the Western Balkans. So, if that's what I want to see, what would such a policy look like? How would such a policy differ from what we have now? Well, what we have now is the Western Balkan nations, each individually embarked on the long, painful trajectory of the stabilization and association process, overseen by the Commission under the extremely able and committed leadership of Commissioner Olli Rehn. We know about this process. It's been in place for a long time. It's the same process that was followed by Hungary and Poland and the other newly joined members of the European Union, where what happens is the Commission sets out a number of tasks to be fulfilled and then essentially stands on the touchline, marking the card as the would-be member nation hopefully scores the required goals and can eventually join. That was what happened, and that was fine for Hungary, Poland, and Lithuania. But the Western Balkan nations are not Hungary, Poland, or Lithuania. They are fractured, and in some cases still fracturing, nations, just emerging from a devastating war. They are all, in one way or another, the subject of a wider process of international peace stabilization, whose proactive task, note the word proactive task, is to build stability, not just wait for it to emerge, and whose contributory nations extend well beyond the European Union, including, for example, the United States, Canada, Russia, Japan, Turkey. The European Commission is itself a member of this coalition, which, incidentally, ab initio, makes it an active player on the field, not just a passive umpire standing on the sidelines. By the way, the European Union also has another heavyweight player in the field in the Balkans, the Council of the European Union, whose assets include two special representatives, one in Macedonia and one in Bosnia. The one in Bosnia is, through double hatting as the High Representative, equipped with the full and powerful panoply of the bond powers to make things happen. The Council's assets, as distinct from the Commission, also includes a large-scale police mission and European Union force in Bosnia, which has replaced NATO as the stabilization force charged with preserving security in that country. The Union's first army in the field is in the Western Balkans. So, the Commission and the Council, who's in charge of all of this? Who is speaking for Europe in the Balkans? Is it the Commission or is it the Council? Well, the rather embarrassing answer is no one knows, because no one can agree. European Constitution, of course, had it gone through, would have resolved the problem. But the Constitution has, as we all know, how shall I put it, stalled. So Europe speaks with a divided voice, even sometimes with a contradictory one, in many parts of the Balkans, not in Macedonia, where the Commission has agreed to allow its head of mission to be double-hatted as the Council's European Union Special Representative. But Macedonia is the exception. Apparently it can't be done elsewhere. So in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and I expect in Belgrade too, there is confusion as to who does what for Europe, with individual European Union nations chipping in on a freelance basis. And I have to rather depressingly say the Commission and the Council not always saying the same thing in the same circumstances, to put it euphemistically. This is deadly if Europe wants to be taken seriously in the Balkans and increase its leverage to make things happen. You know, over 1,000, and I mean no insult here, one of the characteristics I adored about the Balkans is that over 1,000 years of foreign occupation, the nations of the Balkans have become the world's foremost experts at driving wedges to make sure that they can reserve for themselves the things that they want to do. Just folly to make this easier for them to do this. And yet that's exactly what Europe's confused structures operating in the Balkans are currently doing. If we are serious about using Europe's influence in the Balkans effectively to proactively achieve that aim, we have to remedy this structural problem. Secondly, What the European Union also needs to do is to start to look at the region as a whole, rather than as a penny packet collection of policies for individual countries. This has been the West's biggest mistake in the Balkans, in my view. We have chosen a fractured nation-by-nation policy instead of a coordinated regional one. We seem to have concluded that the best way of dealing with the Balkans is to start off by Balkanizing ourselves. And the consequences, of course, have been plain and painful. We recognized Croatia and blew up Bosnia. We finally sorted out the Bosnian problems and, whoops, there goes Kosovo. We sort out Kosovo and, oh, we forgot the pressure of Valley and Macedonia. So we need to change our view. I can tell you this, sitting in the office of Bosnia's High Representative and European Union Special Representative in Sarajevo, there was not one major problem I had to deal with which would not have been easier to solve if it had been dealt with on a regional rather than a national level. From crime to corruption, from the economy to energy, from local regeneration to transport, from agriculture to politics, all of the big issues had strong regional dimensions. And in order to solve the problem locally, you could do that better within a regional construct. All of them would have been easier to solve if our solutions had had a regional element to it. And by the way, that applies most particularly to the region's two biggest unresolved issues, the issues of Kosovo and of Karadzic and Mladic. So what the EU needs is not just a set of detailed policies for Bosnia and another for Serbia, Montenegro, another for Macedonia, and another for Albania, Kosovo, etc., but a single overarching set of policies for the region whose centerpiece is the integration of the region economically, politically, and in every sphere on the basis of European standards. Then we might get effect for the huge amount of money which the European Union is putting in. And by the way, the European Union needs to be much more muscular about its conditionality for the use of that money. The Union pours millions and millions of euros into the region, far more than the United States. But the United States gets far more influence for the money it spends because it speaks with a single voice and is prepared to be much more brutal about the conditionality which it attaches to its largesse. The EU could afford to take a leaf out of the US book and be much less squeamish about what it expects to see for the money that it spends. In the Balkans, you know, a certain muscular straightforwardness is expected and respected. Being a soft touch is not. Next, I want to propose that the European Union should widen the stabilization and association process to include more overtly political aims. One senior commission official once said to me that the European Union was not just a union of peoples and rights, it was also a union of standards. It's a good phrase, and I think an accurate one. But standards, though vital, can be dry things. Nations are made up of more than bundles of technical criteria for economies, customs services, judicial processes, and so on. Countries also need to be organized effectively in order to be able to work effectively. Surely this is a European standard too. The bottom line surely must be that in order to join the Union of States organized to serve their citizens efficiently, the European Union, it must be necessary to meet minimum standards of efficient state organization, whose purpose is to serve the citizens of that state to the same standard as in other European nations. Bosnia, again forgive me for quoting the area I know best, is manifestly far from being in such a state. It is plain to all that Bosnia and Herzegovina must now reform the Dayton Constitution, which, though absolutely essential to the first phase of its journey from war, the stabilization phase, is clearly now an impediment to the second phase, the phase of building a modern, decentralized European state. It is manifest nonsense to pretend that you can join Europe with 13 prime ministers, 13 full-scale governments, for a nation of only 3.5 million people. It is also nonsense to claim that you can win the loyalty of your citizens to create the state that Bosnia should be and will become, while spending 70% of those hard-pressed citizens' taxes just on government, and only 30% on citizen services such as health, education, pensions, and welfare. Manifest nonsense to pretend that that does not have to be changed. And everyone, including every citizen in BIH more or less, knows that it cannot go on like this. And, as a, quote, player on the field, member of the International Peace Stabilization Mission, the European Commission agrees. But in its role as umpire on the sidelines of the stabilization and association process, the Commission has, at least until now, said that constitutions have never been the stuff of SAAs in any other country, and therefore cannot be made so now. And so the European Union and Bosnia and Herzegovina are missing out on an opportunity to exercise the single greatest piece of leverage that it has, the SAA, in order to achieve success in solving the single biggest problem that it has today, constitutional reform. I'm sorry. To be blunt, to me, this represents the triumph of bureaucracy over plain common sense. Lastly, visa-free access. Here's a conundrum for you. Currently, the European Union has negotiated a simplified visa regime with the Russian Federation, which has no immediate aspirations, or no aspirations, as far as I know, to join the European Union, and is conducting similar talks with the Ukraine with the same intent. But the same EU has dragged its feet since Thessaloniki in doing the same for the Balkan countries, despite the fact that all of these countries are now fully embarked on the European path. Finally, at the end of last year, the EU promised to take the first steps towards future negotiations with the West Balkan countries on visa liberalization. Again, I'm afraid to say, on a country-by-country basis. Talks may start in Macedonia this year. But already, some of the EU countries are voicing opposition. And so, the leaders of Europe made their Thessaloniki promise to the citizens of the Western Balkans that they can join the European Union if they reach European Union standards, and the citizens of the Western Balkans have responded by declaring that that is their ambition. And yet we do not allow them even liberalized visa travel to the Europe that they wish and we want them to become a part of. I can tell you from 4 years, nearly 4 years in Sarajevo, that nothing but nothing matters more to the citizens of Bosnia and Herzegovina than having the ability to travel in the Europe that they wish to join. There is no reform they would not contemplate if that was the prize at the end of it. No thing they desire more that Europe can offer them than the chance to have easier access for them and their children to the Europe they rightly feel to be their homeland. So the time has come, it seems to me, to honor the promise of Thessaloniki with a gesture that makes that promise live in the hearts of every citizen of the countries of the Western Balkans by beginning a measured process of progressive liberalization of visas for the region. This should involve a roadmap of reforms that they are required to meet for improving judicial, immigration, and customs systems, leading eventually to visa-free access for the region as they reach the threshold of European Union membership. Well, before I finish, let me just now say something, if I may, to my friends in the Western Balkans, for I have concentrated here on what I think Europe, or rather the European Union, should do in the Western Balkans. May I end with a word or two to my Western Balkan friends about what they might do to maximize their chances of achieving in the shortest time frame possible their ambition to join the European Union. I have three pieces of advice for my Balkan friends. First, don't waste time. I remain confident that Europe's leaders are still, in the main, determined to deliver the promise they made to you in Thessaloniki. But the mood of their people, the mood of their citizens, is changing. The European Union's ever open door to the East may not stay ever open evermore. So you need to make haste, making the reforms that are necessary to qualify for membership of the European Union. Secondly, and for the same reason, do not present yourself as beggars at the gates of Europe, asking to be let in out of charity. Present your case rather to Europe on the basis not of charity, but of the European Union's self-interest. Your argument should be not that Europe owes this to you, but that you can add value to Europe. Thirdly, what this means is locking the countries of the Western Balkans together as fast as possible into a single, integrated, economic, and coherent political space. Strip down as fast as you can the barriers that divide you, and present yourselves as a single market opportunity of over $50 million, an area of growth and a region of crucial geostrategic importance for the European Union. Your case should not be that Europe must afford to bring you in, but that the EU cannot afford to leave you out. Because after 4 years serving Europe and the international community in the Balkans, I passionately believe this is true. The European Union, without the West Balkan countries, would be an EU which had left an abscess from its own past within itself, an EU which continued to be infected with the crime and instability from which the Balkans has not yet fully emerged, and an EU which had crucially missed the last best opportunity to complete the project born of its own wars to overcome the last remnants of those turbulent times and to add strength to itself by incorporating the immense cultural, ethnic, and resource wealth that the Western Balkan countries have to offer. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that marvelous presentation delivered with so much authority. We now have the opportunity of some questions and answers. I can see a number of hands going up. Let me just make the usual reminder. Can you make sure that it is a question rather than a speech? Can I just ask, we do have a microphone, so if you could put up your hand, the microphone will come to you. And can we take the gentleman down here with the red tie in the center, please? I'm sorry, there's a microphone here. It's working.
And if you don't think it's a good idea, why not?
We'll take several questions. Let me just help the audience. I think the microphone worked for the last 2 seconds, which is a crescendo of LSE achievement. The question was essentially, would the solution be for the Bosnian part, but the Bosnian Serbs to join the Republic of Serbia? Yeah.
No, I've got transferred.
I apologize. Okay. Some more questions. The gentleman at the back please, with the red scarf.
I wonder if I could ask, is the former Yugoslavia now a dirty word? And particularly, what about the fact that Albania wasn't in it?
Okay. We'll take one more question. The gentleman here, please. You have. I think you need to switch.
You mentioned that it would have been much better to handle the issues in Bosnia on a regional basis than step by step or region by region. But, well, if we look at the way the international community has handled the issues in general, it has been extremely selective, both in its interventions and its policies. In this respect, I would like you to put this simple question. The international community has been asking the Montenegros to secede from Serbia. How would the international community think, would react to a demand from the Bosnian Serbs to unite with Serbia on the same basis as the Montenegros? By having a referendum.
Okay, thanks. If we take those questions, then we'll have another round, if that's okay. It's a nice, easy question.
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously the same. Is it a good idea if Republika Srpska is somehow handed over lock, stock and barrel to Serbia? No, is the answer, on a number of reasons. First of all, the international community is not encouraging Montenegro to break away from Serbia-Montenegro. It's doing the opposite.
But it recognizes the right.
It recognizes the right for Montenegro to hold a referendum.
Yes.
My view is that it's almost inevitable that Montenegro will break away. We might get on to the dangers if that happens, but it can't be stopped, and there's a reason for that. Montenegro is a country. It's been a country for a very long time indeed. Serbia, Republika Srpska is not. The area in which Republika Srpska exists is in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And if you want to start accepting that as a principle, then why not the Vojvodina? Would happily vote to return to Hungary. What about the Sanjak? The Sanjak would happily vote, no doubt, to join either Bosnia and Herzegovina or Montenegro. Do you really want to go into a position where you refracture the whole of the area of the Balkans? Surely the right solution is that we understand that the solution, there used to be a thing called the Schleswig-Holstein question, which you nearly fought wars about. I can't remember what it was, and it was Gladstone, I think, who said there are only three people alive who knew the answer to the Schleswig-Holstein question. One's dead, one's mad, and the other's me, and I've forgotten. Now, it doesn't matter, because the European Union, the magic of the European Union is by providing this overarching structure, borders no longer have to be changed, so they don't matter anymore. The Serbs of Republika Srpska can join forces with the Serbs of Belgrade on their way to Europe within the European Union, which is the argument that we constantly used. And if you are now to say, fine, we will do this bargaining, redrawing, playing the old 19th century game of drawing maps, let me tell you, the one thing that could lead the Balkans back to war in very short order is the idea that you should somehow change over a part of Bosnia and Herzegovina, an internationally recognized state, against the wishes of the majority, to its neighboring state of Serbia. But ask yourself this question. What do you do with the Bosnians who have now settled there? What do you do with the Muslim population, the Bosniak population? What do you do with the tens of thousands that have come back into Srebrenica? What do you do with the Bosniak majority that is in Kozarac now? Where the death camps were, they have the courage to go back. You're going to hand them over to Bosniaks? Is that what you're going to do? And let me tell you what you'd also be doing. You'd be doing something exceedingly dangerous. If ever you concede in the Balkans that you are in favor of creating ethnically pure spaces, you have embarked the Balkans straight on a route back to war. And that's what you'd be doing. You would be saying you can create an ethnically pure space, a Lebensraum, if you like, for the Serbs to live in, and for the Bosniaks to live in, and for the Croats to live in. And that will not be a safe way forward. The trick of the Balkans, it seems to me, is to take the multi-ethnic character of the Balkans and do everything you can to preserve that. And the fact that Bosnia and Herzegovina today is a multi-ethnic space in which live increasingly
what's the word I'm trying to reach for? Increasingly tolerantly, and yet love each other. Bosniaks, Croats, and Serbs is the essential nature of Bosnia and Herzegovina. That would be destroyed if you then said, okay, Serbs and Republika Srpska, you can vote to rejoin Serbia. And by the way, Croats and Herzegovina, help yourself, have a referendum and rejoin Croatia. You'd have created a small Bosniak enclave in the middle of Muslims, and I dare say a great number would return to there, and I'm telling you, you would march yourself straight back to conflict as quickly as you can. So on all grounds, I think this is madness. And by the way, it's madness now which not very many people believe in. I don't say that in the dark recesses of President Kostunica, Kostunica is wonderful not to be a diplomat. I don't say that for a moment in the dark cobwebbed recesses of President Kostunica's back offices there aren't some rather foolish people who still believe this is possible. I don't even say that in the mountain fastnesses of Eastern Republika Srpska there aren't some recidivists of the old days who'd like to return, who would like to believe, dream this as a dream. But very few sensible people now put this forward as a sensible proposition, and I'm glad they don't. By the way, I'm not sure that a solution in Kosovo will have an effect in Bosnia and Herzegovina. The last time Kosovo blew up, which was in March last year, almost nothing happened in Bosnia. Well, it's not quite true. There was a hand grenade thrown into a mosque in Doboj, but that happens quite a few Friday nights, and it's much more to do with Slivovica than it is, I think, with Kosovo. But there was almost nothing happened. Provided there is not an exodus in blood of the Serbs in Kosovo, that's the bit that worries me, provided they feel there is a home and, for them in the new Kosovo, then I don't believe that there will be the disruption that some people believe will happen in Bosnia and Herzegovina. I don't say there won't be a claim for a referendum, but I don't think many people take that very seriously. Even the remarkably brave and extraordinarily able president of Republika Srpska, Dragan Čović, I think is one of the most interesting politicians emerging in the Balkans, by the way, has recognized that this is crazy and is not pursuing this line. So I think this is a line pursued by people who like to see neatness rather than deal with reality and what's proper on the ground. Is Yugoslavia a dirty word? Yeah. I mean, not for me it isn't. I think Yugoslavia was a remarkable nation. It had a lot wrong with it, but it had a lot right with it as well. By the way, if there is one area of the Western Balkans that preserves the multi-ethnic quality of Yugoslavia, it's probably more Bosnia and Herzegovina than any other part of the Balkans. But yeah, for many people it's a dirty word in the Balkans at present. I think it's part of history. I don't believe it'll come back again. But I think the Balkans will find themselves at peace on the basis of multi-ethnicity without the problems of borders in the same way as we do within the European Union.
Good. Let's take some more questions. The gentleman at the front, please.
Thanks for your comments, Lord Ashton. A very interesting lecture. There's two parts to my question. Firstly, many member states are quite wary of future enlargement, especially when it comes to Turkey. The word being bandied around is for cultural reasons, and many read into that anti-Islamic and religious concerns. Do you think the presence of a large Muslim population in the Balkans is actually hindering their case for future enlargement? And the second part is actually related to that. There's also an idea of special associative status for these countries. Is that going to be enough for the Balkans to maintain the momentum in reform and keeping the area stable? Thank you.
Thanks. Could we take the gentleman here back? We can take questions from upstairs as well, yeah, if that's okay.
Thank you. Should the European Union specify that all of the countries should join at the same time as a means of reinforcing a regional approach?
Thank you. And a question here at the front.
Thank you. Lord Ashton, in holding up prospect of European Union membership, should the emphasis be upon the bringing to justice of alleged war criminals, or should there be some emphasis upon some form of reconciliation, such as has happened in Northern Ireland and South Africa?
Thank you. I'm going to take those for the moment.
Is the presence of a Muslim population, an Islamic population, in the Western Balkans something that's making more difficulty about enlargement? I honestly don't think it is. I mean, I never heard it quoted. I've never heard it, you know, this being an argument that's used. Maybe it's just too brutal, people can't say it, but actually they're worried about it underneath. I don't think most people in Europe realize there is this ancient European Islam in the Balkans. I just don't think they even know it's there. They know it's there in Turkey, and for some bizarre reason it seems to be frightening to people. So I don't think it is an inhibition yet, and I hope it won't become one. As you've heard me argue, I think it is one of the reasons why we should embrace the Western Balkans. I think this gives a quality and dimension to Europe that it has from no other one of its constituent nations. And if you regard one of the world's major problems today as the confrontation between what I've referred to as ancient Christendom and its more modern descendants, and modern Islam, then it has, I think, a real unique role to play in changing a dialogue of the deaf to a dialogue of understanding. So I think it is one of the assets of the Western Balkans. I don't think it's a particular problem at the moment, though clearly it is in relation to Turkey. The SAA, the Stabilization Association process to which you referred, is it enough? Not in its present form, no. I mean, I don't give a damn what you call the thing. You can call it the green cheese process if you want to. It's what it does that matters. And unfortunately, I'm slightly simplifying here now to make the effect, but the European Union has been so immensely successful with the SAA process in laying out standards and then watching Poland and Hungary and Lithuania and this immense enlargement that it thinks it can apply that everywhere else in exactly the same way. It's a formulaic bureaucratic approach which has succeeded in the past, and therefore they say it will succeed in the future. I don't think it will. I think that if Europe wants to, you can call it the SAA process if you like, but give it some teeth. Realize that you're not just standing at the touchline watching things happen. You're an active player on the field making them happen. So I would like to see the Thessaloniki promise converted into a policy of active intent to make this happen. And then you can use the SAA process to achieve that in ways that I've discussed. Widen its process, give it some political aims, and be much more muscular about the use of Europe's largesse. If we leave the SAA process there, will it be enough? I don't think it will be within the time frame we're talking about. I think the SAA process, as this passive process that I've described, it will take too long for this to happen. And I worry about the impact of external events, the unpredictable external events on that process. I worry about the changing mood of Europe on that. And I worry a bit about the maintenance of the reform drive in the Western Balkans if this goes on for too long a time. Let me just say the other thing. It is the only glue that keeps this region together. The prospect of joining Europe is the only glue that holds this region together and firmly on the stabilization path. I was invested with the bond piles while I was there. I can tell you that the prospect of joining Europe, doing the things that were necessary to join Europe, was a far greater impetus to bring about the really essential reforms that we carried out in Bosnia and Herzegovina than the stick of the bomb powers. Now, if you maintain that magnetism, the European magnetic pull, then I think you can keep the nation, this region, on the stabilization and reform process. If you take that magnetism away, if the voices I hear getting louder in Europe at present win the day, and we decide that we're going to put up the barriers and let no one else in, then I worry. I worry about what this region could revert back to. I don't say overnight. It won't happen overnight. And I don't say we'll get back to, you know, ethnic cleansing. I'm not saying any of that. I'm not saying we'll go back to war even. I'm just saying we will have an area of ill governance and of
instability, potential instability, and a nest of an area, not a nest, an area in which criminality would exist right in our middle. And we need to remember that lawlessness, lawless spaces, give rise to the threats that we currently are facing in the world. If you leave a lawless space, you don't finish the process of bringing a nation to stability as part of the international community, and you leave a lawless space instead, it comes back to bite you. We remember that with Afghanistan. And it would be a dangerous thing, in my view, for Europe not to understand that those dangers could exist in the Balkans if it should change its mind on the Thessaloniki promise. Should they all join at the same time? No, I don't think they should. I think we should hold to a process that each of these is on a track which is parallel but not coincidental, that we're moving in the same direction, along the same path, but necessarily perhaps at different speeds. I mean, I certainly would not recommend that we should reverse the process in Croatia to wait for the other European countries. As every one of these European, West Balkan countries joins the European Union, it makes it better and more likely, and it provides a greater impetus for others to do so too. The fact that Croatia is now joining the European Union was an immense boost to the Balkans. They said, Europe means it and we can do it. And I think it's very important that we should allow each of the countries to develop along their own path. But part of that path should be coordinating their structures amongst themselves. I mean, look, the truth is that this is one space. You know, it may not be a single economic space yet, though it should be, but it's certainly a single criminal space. Belgrade's criminals are Banja Luka's criminals. They don't pay any attention to the border in between, and by the way, they don't pay any attention to the ethnic dividing lines either. We should be saying that in all matters related to the creation of a single economic space, a single customs space, a single tariff space, a single space of law and order, part of the SAA process will not just be about you achieving those standards, but also coordinating your standards to create a single integrated region. I don't see there's anything inconsistent with that, with allowing each of the countries to progress at their own pace. I don't think you can have peace without justice. And whilst I do not say that every dotted I, and it is necessary to have every dotted I and cross T of justice down to the lowest possible level, I do say that the primary architects of these horrors have to be brought to justice. And of course that means that the two primary architects, Karadzic and Mladic, have to be brought to justice. Why couldn't that happen in the last 10 years? Well, NATO is blamed, the international community is blamed. The people who have failed to provide what was necessary to capture these were the Serb authorities. There was no cooperation from the Serb authorities. I'm very glad to say that we have now broken the barrier of cooperation. As of the 1st of January last year, not a single one of the Hague indictees had been transferred to the Hague by the authorities, either in Banja Luka or Belgrade. Now, 11 of those 15, Karadzic and Mladic's chief henchmen, are now in the Hague, transferred by one means or another, by the Serb authorities in Belgrade and Banja Luka. They are now actively cooperating in order to ensure that this process is finished. So whatever happens, we cannot move to the next phase of stabilization without Karadzic and Mladic in The Hague, and I think the European Union is absolutely right to make that an absolutely concrete condition. They had to do that with Gotovina and succeeded. They have to do it with Karadzic and Mladic too. Now, beyond that, it may be possible to think about a truth and reconciliation process, but I don't think the time is ripe yet. By the way, I think it's more important to have the truth first and perhaps reconciliation later. So a truth commission may be a useful thing to start off with, but it's not right yet to do that. I can't go up to a mother of Srebrenica who passes a policeman in Zvornik who she knows killed her son and her father and her grandfather or was involved in the death squad that put them to death and say, forgive. I can't do that. Until you have borne the major burden of bringing people to justice, until you have created an understanding of the truth and come to terms with your history, I don't think you can embark on a truth and reconciliation process. So I'm bound to say that I think the South African standard style truth and reconciliation process in Bosnia and Herzegovina will have its day sometime, and I hope sometime soon, but not now. By the way, BIH is about to do that most difficult thing of all, try its own war criminals before its own courts. It's pretty remarkable that they've been able to do that. But that's going to happen very soon. And making sure that that begins to happen is an essential prerequisite before you can move on to the next phase as well. Sorry, I'm being a bit long.
That's okay. Another round of questions. If we could take the lady in the centre, please.
Hi. When it comes to joining EU, how do you see the Western Balkans, especially Bosnia and Croatia, in comparison to Bulgaria and Romania that are about to join EU, especially in terms of economics and human rights?
Okay. Thank you. Question down here, please.
Thank you. Seems the sound system is being managed by the international community. It's working now. Anyway, my question is, you started your speech by saying that you had to try to come to terms with what the international community and what the people in Bosnia wanted. I want to ask, which one was easier, to identify what the international community wanted or what was the best for the people of Bosnia? And was it possible to merge the two?
Thanks. We'll try to go live to the balcony. Can we have the lady in the centre, please?
I have two questions concerning Kosovo. The first is, by when will Kosovo be an independent and internationally recognised country with passports and everything? The second question is, how can the Serbs in Kosovo be encouraged to remain there, and those who fled Kosovo during the conflict or afterwards, how can they be encouraged to come back?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Whilst we are in the balcony, can we take one further question here, please?
You seem to find justification in Montenegro becoming independent in the fact that it was a state. Where can you find similar justifications for Kosovo becoming independent?
Should we take this?
Yeah. The Western Balkans. Listen, I'm well aware of the fact that I'm speaking to an audience here, a great number of whom don't have English as your maternal language. So forgive me for this little joke. It's always a dangerous thing to tell a joke. When I was being elected Member of Parliament, we used to have to appear before the National Farmers Union of Great Britain, that looks after the interests of farming. And it is a deadly, dangerous appearance, because they ask you technical questions which you haven't got an answer for. On one occasion, I was addressing a very full group meeting of farmers, and one of them says, "What do we think about the price of barley, then? What do you think about the price of barley?" And I said, "I don't know anything about the price of barley." And he said, "I'm voting for E." He said, "I'm voting for you." I said to him afterwards, "Excuse me, I couldn't answer your question because I don't know anything about it." And he said, "That's right," he said. "I asked the other two about this and they went on for an hour and a half, and we don't grow barley within 150 miles of here." I don't know anything about the situation in Bulgaria and Romania. I'm sorry, I can't make the comparison you'd wish me to make with Bosnia and Herzegovina. The European Union is there to do that. I mean, we all know that all these countries have some way to travel yet. They've set certain standards. Forgive me, I'm just not able to make a comparison. What I can tell you is this, that what matters in life, what matters in politics, isn't just where you are, it's the direction you're traveling. And it is just amazing to me how far this little country of Bosnia and Herzegovina has come in 10 years. You think that 250,000 people, maybe an overestimate, but 250,000 people were killed, a 16th of the population, half were driven from their homes. You can imagine that, you know, unlike Cyprus, 25 years afterwards, it's not divided. Complete freedom of movement across the country. Unlike the Basque country of Spain, it started its terrorist problems, 20 years ago. There's absolutely peaceful elections here, held by the Bosnians themselves. It's got a growing economy, it's got stable inflation, it's got 1 million refugees, the first time in history that have returned. slowly by slowly. I mean, I'm absolutely convinced that Bosnia and Herzegovina, the worst part of this journey is now behind them. However difficult it is to do the things they've yet got to do to become a member of the European Union, the things they've done already to live together, not love each other, but live together, and cohabitation is the beginning, cooperation will come later, is an absolute miracle after that, after such a short period of time. So we'll see. There's a long way to go yet. No doubts about that. I'm sure Romania and Bulgaria are much further advanced along the road. But I'm very convinced that this remarkable little country is going to get there at the end of the day. And it will get there particularly if we make sure that we are determined to maintain that magnetic pull I referred to earlier on. Which is most difficult? Well, now, you see, I can now be unbuttoned, can't I? When I went to Bosnia and Herzegovina to do this job, someone said to me, it's like herding cats, you know. And what they meant was that the Bosnian and Herzegovinian citizens, actually a bit like the liberals, really, a bit like the liberal Democrats, didn't like to be told what to do, and getting them all going in the same direction was something which wasn't very easy to do. And of course, it did turn out to be quite wonderful fun and a great experience, and I was very privileged to do the job. But what I didn't realize is like herding cats in two directions, because the thing that took up most of my time was not trying to get the BIH authorities to do what was necessary to follow the reform process. It was trying to get the international community, which was supposed to be behind me, on the same page and going in the same direction. Which of these two was more difficult? I wouldn't like to tell you. I spent more time trying to make sure the international community were together in Bosnia and Herzegovina than I did trying to get things happening in BIH. But what I'm very clear about is this, that doing that job, I was accountable. People say, oh, Paddy Ashton's not accountable for bond powers, can do whatever he likes. It's absolute nonsense. And arguably, I was accountable to too many people, because I didn't have a single international boss. I had four. I'm accountable to the UN Security Council. I was accountable to the European Union, whose special representative I was. I was accountable to the PIC countries, the peace implementation countries, and let me tell you, if I'd have done anything which they disagreed with, that could have caused me a considerable problem. And above all, I was accountable to the Bosnian people. I mean, if the BIH people had decided I'd made the decision about establishing a single intelligence agency, and they'd said no, the power's gone the next moment. So at the end of the day, you had to take decisions which you believed would have the best interest and support of the BIH people themselves. And they're not slow about telling you if they think you're wrong. So, a bit like the liberals, really. Which of these two? I couldn't tell you. It was the most difficult. But I wouldn't have missed the last 4 years for all the tea in China, as they say. When will Kosovo be recognized? I really don't know. I personally am quite attracted to the idea that was put forward by the Amato Commission. Very, very interesting idea. That up until now, in order to join the European Union, you had to be a state first, and then you could join the European Union. What Amato proposed was that, in fact, we should allow Kosovo to skip that stage, that you could join the European Union as something less than a total state. It's quite an interesting idea. I mean, if you think, forgive me if I go on for too long here.
It's okay.
Long have we got?
It's okay.
If you think about the world, it's made up on this binary system created by the 19th century strategists and politicians, which is you're either a state or you're nothing. But actually, there are all sorts of things that are in between a state and nothing, which we still have to recognize. Palestine is not a state. There's a lot of elements, and they're the ones around which most of the problems are concentrated, which are neither states nor nothing. They are entities on the scene. Now, question, is there a way within the immense flexibility, vision, overarching structure of Europe that we can cope with that notion in a more formalistic fashion? Perhaps there is. So I think Kosovo is a very difficult issue indeed to solve, but I'm absolutely convinced it can only be solved within the overarching structure of the European Union. And within a structure of the European Union operating regionally within Bosnia and Herzegovina. If we can create that structure, if we can provide the safeguards through the European Union that we cannot provide by acknowledging statehood, then maybe there's a way through this. I personally think there is. How do we enable the Serbs in Kosovo to feel that they're safe, not by creating an entity, in my view, because these would be two monoethnic entities. If you create, divide Kosovo into two entities, they will be monoethnic entities. And there's a principle about entities: provided you can maintain their multi-ethnic character, fine. But if you allow them to become monoethnic, a Serb entity in the north, a Kosovo entity in the south, this will inevitably happen, that the northern entity will migrate to Serbia for all effective purposes, and the southern entity probably won't migrate to Albania, because there's no love lost between Albanians and Kosovar Albanians, but it will become a much more difficult problem to deal with. So by providing them with adequate protections and human rights, I suppose, is my answer. Montenegro, the question was, just remind me, you said, about Kosovo. Look, I wish it wasn't true, but you have to deal with the facts of life. And the fact of life is this, that whether you like it or not, the Serbs lost the moral right to govern Kosovo on the basis of 5% of the population as a result of what they did in the 1997-1998 war. Now, let's just accept that. Has Kosovo been a state in the same sense Montenegro has been? No. But nevertheless, what happened in the 1997-1998 war meant that the Serbs who occupied 5% of the population lost the moral right to govern that country. And you cannot say to the Kosovars, you're going to be part of Belgrade again, because it's completely unacceptable to them. And it would be unacceptable to me if I was one of them too. So whether Belgrade likes it or not, the idea of Kosovo being administered by Belgrade, they lost that as a result of what happened in the 1997 war. Now you have to deal with that reality. You have to deal with what is a real fact on the ground. So there is not an equivalence between Montenegro and Kosovo in terms of their claims to statehood. But then there's not an equivalence between Montenegro and Kosovo in terms of their recent history either. And so somehow or another you have to construct a solution which accommodates both of those facts.
Okay, I think we must bring matters to a conclusion. Let me, however, on your behalf, give our warm thanks to our speaker. I think I warned you that the questions would be nice and simple and you could relax here on stage, but you've risen to the challenge, so many, many thanks. Can we show our appreciation to Lord Ashdown? Thank you.